What technology can and can't do to aid first responders on the ground in Florida? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Molly Wood. About 2 weeks ago, part of a 12-story condominium in Surfside, Florida, collapsed. Dozens of people were killed, dozens more are unaccounted for. Images of cranes and giant shovels, along with lines of first responders carefully removing buckets of debris, reveal the scale of the difficult task of finding those still missing. While sniffer dogs and emergency personnel working by hand are still doing most of the work, there is a variety of technology, old and new, aiding them. First in the attempt to rescue any survivors, now for the recovery of victims, and as part of the effort to understand exactly why the building collapsed. Robin Murphy is the director of the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue. We caught up with her shortly after she arrived in Florida, there to support colleagues at Florida State University. She was just outside what she called the drone zone, the base of operations for those using the tech to work the site.
We've got drones, Pelican cases, chargers, laptops, every which way, as we all recharge the equipment, take out the little SD cards, transfer things, create maps, annotate different images, and get them pushed up through the internet to the server for the instant command.
How do these tools aid not just in the recovery of victims or finding victims, but also in keeping the first responders safe?
A major challenge in any kind of search and rescue of a building collapse is the structure may just be unstable. How do you know until you get there? Well, you know, then you get into this catch-22. With robots, they can look and fly into buildings. You can have ground robots go in and look while the structure specialists are coming, giving data to the structure specialist to make that call whether it's safe for people to go in to do a more systematic search.
What other kinds of technology are assisting those first responders?
We do have some other technologies use LIDAR. So you're using scanning lasers to get elevation maps, to get distances, things like that. And there's been some work that we've seen out there with multispectral imagery, trying to experiment and see what else we can see by looking at different spectrum of light that we don't normally look at. I cannot say enough for the respect for the responders and task forces. You know, when you're extracting human remains, we all, the dignity, the care, the solemnity of which they're working, I don't know that we want to delegate that to a robot. We just don't want to shovel that out. And I remain touched and honored by their hard work.
That's such an interesting point, that there are just some jobs that robots either cannot or should not do.
Think of robots as tools. They're not here, and they would never replace responders or dogs. They're like fire trucks. You don't think of a fire truck saving a life, but you do think of fire trucks helping firefighters save lives. So think of robots that way. Their technologies to extend what the responders can do in real time. They let them see and act in real time to go into places that they can't get into any other way. And so they're a big tool.
How has the role of technology and robots being used in these situations changed since, say, 9/11?
The big difference is the drones. Drones didn't exist. This type of drones that we have these days didn't exist in 2001. We didn't really start seeing them about 2004. First use was at Hurricane Katrina. When we were at the World Trade Center, to just get a map of the entire block of all the buildings and the debris was taking about a day. That now takes an hour from launch to product to go out, fly the building, collapse, get it. An hour.
As the director of the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue, you've seen this sort of tech deployed all over the place. Who's been funding all of this technological development over the years?
Funding for technological development is really is really tricky. And I think that's one of the challenges. Emergency response is not known for having a lot of money, right? And in a way, that's good. It means that disasters are relatively rare. Drones have been super because there's been a consumer push for these small drones. We're talking about drones you can get are being used that are, you basically get them from Amazon. They're between $1,000 and $3,000. So they're inexpensive. There's lots of them. They're hardened. They're small. They fit in your hand. You can pick them up. So that's really been driven by the consumer market, right? People who want to have videos to fly for fun, for drone racing, all that. So that's really made really reliable drones that are well suited for this type of 24/7 operation. Keep the cost down. But there's the ground robots, there's not as much commercial incentive to build those. And they tend to be on the order of $150,000 to $175,000. And you can imagine a lot of fire departments and police departments can't really afford that.
Robin Murphy is the director of the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue. And now for some related links. The Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue has its own YouTube channel, which has several videos on how drones and other types of robots can be used in a variety of emergency events, including a marine robot that can quickly reach refugees and others in distress in the water and help them get to safety. We'll have links on our website, marketplacetech.org. Digital Trends has a story about drones fitted with special microphones and sensors to quickly locate someone screaming, which could have uses for finding people who are lost or in danger. And Robin Murphy also spoke to the website The Conversation about what robots can and can't do in situations like the Surfside collapse and the kind of robots she wished existed, one of which would have the characteristics of, as she put it, a ferret. Of course, this kind of tech existing is one thing, but getting funding to get it to local communities who would hopefully never need it is something else entirely. Jesus Alvarado, Sasha Fernandez, Stephanie Hughes, and Michael Lipkin produced the show. Our engineer is Justin Dueler. I'm Kimberly Adams, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.